not shattering myths. Our number for those who would like to participate in this conversation is 877-300-7645. We're considering the testimony that Yahweh provided in his Torah. The first book of the Torah is called Bereshith. It means in the beginning. It's been misnamed Genesis. God said, "Let there be light," and light existed. The Almighty saw that the light was good, and God separated light from darkness. The first statement here is interesting in that God said Amar. He spoke light into existence. If you want to know what else God said, the only place that you can find that information is to observe. That means to examine and consider, to focus on the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. That is where we are given the opportunity to read what God said. In this case, he said, "Let there be light." He said, "I want light to exist," and light existed. If you wish to continue to exist, the only way that you can do so is to read and embrace what God said about prolonged existence. Those instructions, that testimony from Yah, what he had to say about our continued existence is presented in one place, the Torah. The Almighty saw that light was good. So God is equating light, which he equates to himself, which he equates to his Torah, all is being good, pleasant, cheerful, agreeable, of a higher nature, beautiful, beneficial, generous, prosperous, reliable, and true. God associates all of these attributes to light, to himself, and to his Torah. And God separated light from darkness. This separation is the essence of the choice we are all being offered. We can accept Yahweh's invitation to be called out of this world, to be separated from human institutions, and to embrace him along the terms and conditions of his covenant, or reject him. Those are our choices. Now, the pace of time at a location with greater mass. And we're now considering what God said in the context of what he has revealed. We know that greater mass, energy, and velocity slows the pace with which time flows. Now, the article that I was sharing with you, and we're now into the second of two, the realization that the speed of light may not be constant, that it may well have slowed and probably has slowed appreciably over time, and that there's far more support for that than just the one experiment that we were considering, the one conducted in Australia and published in Nature, that there are another dozen tests that have all come to the same conclusion. What that does is to tell us that the universe is not nearly as old relative to the flow of time as from our perspective looking back. That's basically all it does, is that the universe, including our solar system, isn't nearly as old as we think it is. That the estimate of 13.772 billion years may not even be close. It may be off by a magnitude of 10 to the 10th power. That's what we are discovering here with light. But it doesn't change either of the two fundamental aspects of the general theory of relativity, as Davis was suggesting. We know for certain that Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, is valid. We learned that it was valid when the United States blew up Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The atomic bomb is absolute proof that E equals mc squared. The reality that time flows at a different rate relative to speed or mass is proven every day. Our GPS satellites traveling at a greater speed than the cars, boats, and airplanes that they feed information to requires us to speed up the clocks on those satellites, which are slowed down by their speed, for the information to be accurate. We also know that we look at the sun's clock, which is running 2.12 divided by 1 million percent slower than the Earth's. It loses 67 seconds a year because the our clock on the Earth is in the presence of massively less mass than a clock on the sun. And so light emitted from the sun has a wavelength which reflects this slowness of time, relative slowness of time, which is measured as 67 seconds a year. We can run that test any day and prove that time is relative to the observer. And that's just the known universe, this reality of the concentration of energy now, because we know that at our sun, the time runs slower than it does on Earth. But now consider the fact how much mass was at creation to understand the timepiece at creation, because there are, our sun is an average star in a relatively average, galaxy. And that there are 100 billion such galaxies, each averaging 100 billion stars like our sun. And that all of that represents 4% of the energy that was at the Big Bang. So there, if we're noticing this 67 seconds a year in slowing of time, with just light around our sun, now imagine 100 billion suns and 100 billion galaxies. So 100 billion, 100 billion suns, and that representing 4% of the total mass and energy, and consider how slow time would flow in that environment. Now, fortunately, we don't have to guess at the rate that time flowed in these conditions. The measurement is screaming out to us in one form. It is observable in a second medium. It is calculable in a third, and the rate is deducible in a fourth venue. The pace time flowed at creation cries out from the entire universe in the photon radiation in the form of cosmic microwave background. This is CMB, an elongated part of the electromagnetic spectrum. The CMB, the cosmic microwave background, is a measure of the residual heat left over from the time that photons were first freed to travel, which was about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. Discovered at the Bell Labs by Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias in 1965, cosmic microwave background radiation is the residue of the aftermath of the creation event, and thus provides us with a cosmic clock calibrated to a time close to the first day of Genesis, of Bereshith. In the CMB wavelength, we find that it is stretched approximately 1 million millionfold. Suggesting that Genesis time, creation time, flows slower by a factor of 10 to the 12th. Now, we'll return to that thought in a moment, but before we do, I think it is germane to also realize that the slowing of the light speed, which would have an influence over this, is not the only jolt to science. You know, the jolt of the fact that dark energy and dark matter, matter and energy unknown to us, represents 96% of the universe was a pretty good jolt in itself. The fact that galaxies are retreating from us faster than the speed of light was a big jolt to us. The fact that that the fossil records now prove that there was not time for macroevolution to take place was a big jolt to us. But another jolt has just come across the horizon, and that's an article that we will consider one day next week. Turns out that the microwave background radiation that we're considering here from the Big Bang, which shows that time slowed by a factor of 10 to the 12th at the event of the Big Bang, that was not the beginning of time. Scientists have now found radiation that predates the Big Bang. So we'll return to that and cover that story one day next week. Now, a second glimpse of the Creator's clock can be gleaned by observing the redshift, or lengthening of wavelengths emitted from the oldest and most distant sources of light, and comparing this expansion to the rate the universe has and is still growing. To understand this, we turn to Professor Peebles, who was named the Albert Einstein Professor of Science at Princeton University. In his textbook, The Principles of Physical Cosmology, which was printed by Princeton University Press, Philip Peebles, who has established himself as the world's foremost authority in cosmology, explains that when the universe was small, it was doubling very rapidly. But as the cosmos grew, the time required to double got exponentially longer. He, concurring with all cosmological texts, quotes 10 to the 12th as the average rate of expansion. This yields a general relationship between Genesis time and time today, indicating that they are different by a factor of 1 million million. All right? So if you want to calibrate your clock to the time of the Creator at creation, you have to slow down your clock by a factor of 1 million million, or you will not be on the same clock that he is using to describe time. Now, this concept is actually fairly simple. When space was stretched, so were the wavelengths within it. The redshift, or stretching due to the expansion of space, is commonly observed in astronomical data and is now confirmed by the flow of a trillion times, showing us, confirming, that time flowed a trillion times slower than it does today. So, we are going to consider, when we return to this program in a moment, the calculable insight into creation's clock and how it differs from ours today, so we understand our Genesis. Considering the three methods of being able to determine the flow of time relative to Yahweh at the point of creation, and the third insight into creation's clock and how it differs from ours today is found by dividing the temperature of quark confinement. That is, the temperature when light energy could be successfully transformed into matter. That number for you Calvinites out there is, by the way, it's Kelvin, it's K-E-L-V-I-N, as opposed to the Calvin of predestination fame in Protestant Christianity. That number is 10.9 to 10 to the 12th Kelvin. And that temperature following the Big Bang can be compared to the temperature of the universe at large. The average temperature of space now is 2.73 degrees Kelvin. That is the measure of the CMB. So you can compare 2.73 degrees Kelvin to 10.9 times 10 to the 12th Kelvin to have a measure of the difference of the flow of time at one place versus another at the time immediately following the Big Bang to time flowing today. Now, this ratio enables us to compare the amount of energy concentrated near the point of creation with that which exists today. This is relevant because the more energy which is present, the slower time moves. The resulting calculation serves to confirm that our clock here on Earth runs at 0.399 times 10 to the 12th faster than the Creator's clock would have run at the time that he created the universe. Now, we'll bring all that together in a moment, but we have Jason calling in from Pennsylvania, and he wants to speak about light as well. Hello, Jason. Welcome to the program.
Oh, bless you, Yada. I just wanted to say to you really quick a comment on the way that you just described our concept of the passage of time as opposed to Yaz's concept of the passage of time, which, of course, he's outside of. But it just, to me, it's incredible the way you so eloquently and just concise, like a laser, the information you gave was just, it blew my concept of out of the water of, okay, now I understand why it would, to Yosha, it's like 2 seconds since he left.
Oh, absolutely. That's coming to understand the nature of time and the nature of light and the relationship between light and time has an enormous influence on our perspective of God, of ourselves, of the creation of the universe, of what the covenant holds for us, its benefits, about how God went about proving that we can rely upon his Torah, prophets, and Psalms as being true, the way that God went about proving his existence. All of this is enveloped in the concept of time. Once you understand time and you understand the association, the interconnectivity between light and time, and the relationship between Yahweh and light, and therefore time, then you have a perspective to understand enormous swaths of God's testimony. You understand who we are, why we're here, where we're going, who God is, and how all of this has been presented to us. So while it might sound a little bit, you know, complicated and, you know, why in the world, if you're going to present Yah's testimony, are you getting so in-depth in light and time? Well, it is the key to really understanding who God is and what he's offering us.
Absolutely. And I recommend anybody that hears this today, go back and listen to the show yesterday, because I was lucky enough to catch you today and yesterday. Yada, I have to say to you, the teachings that you're bringing out with the study of Bereshit, it's just absolute. It's blown my intellectual mind into another level, and the understanding, you know. So I just want to suggest one thing to you, maybe before I let you go.
Yes, sure, good.
I think you should maybe think about doing a DVD of this teaching, because I'm telling you, the understandings that came from just me listening to you the past 2 days, it's really helped me, brother. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Jason. You know, yesterday we did take a little different approach to understanding time and the general theory of relativity than I had taken before. It's different even than what, not different, but augments what I had written before, explaining how to properly understand the theory of relativity, which is essential to understanding God's clock and his nature. And when we return to Shattering Myths, I'll review some of that material. And thank you, Jason, for bringing these things to our attention. We'll be back in a moment. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yana. What we were talking about there with Jason bears repeating. We talked about some of this yesterday, but before we get back into this this presentation of time specifically relative to creation, let's just take a moment and review why we're talking about time, why we're talking about light, and the connectivity between time and light. Light was the first thing God said that he created. In a passage from Yeshayahu, whom we've misnamed Isaiah, a couple of days ago, we revealed that Yahweh equates himself to light, and says that he is our light. And so there is a direct correlation between Yahweh and light. If we want to understand Yahweh, we need to visualize him with the same nature as is the nature of light. Now, since God says that he created us in his image, but that when we are reborn spiritually as part of his covenant family, that we are empowered and that we become ever more like him, it means that we also are going to take on the characteristics of light. And so it's important for us to understand the nature of spiritual energy, of light energy, and because it's not only it describes what God himself is like, but what we are going to be like. But beyond this, it actually illuminates so much that helps us understand how God could have told us in our past what would happen in our future without predestining it to happen. The moment prophecy becomes predestination, then the fundamental purpose of the universe is destroyed, which is to give us free will so that we can choose whether or not we want to participate in his covenant. And so the way that God can tell us in our past what's going to happen in our future is for him to not be stuck in time, for him to be like light and to be able to perceive the past, the present, and the future simultaneously. God's not stuck in time like we are. And so he has witnessed our future. He didn't predestine the future. He's just having witnessed where our choices lead us, where our actions lead us, and reported in our past what our choices caused. Therefore, he is always right. That's why he says, you want to know if testimony is coming from me or not? The standard is 100% accuracy, because he's not predicting, he's reporting. So 100% accuracy. When you find thousands of specific and detailed predictions that came true exactly as they were reported in our past and are materializing before our eyes, the only rational and logical conclusion is that the author of these statements was not constrained by time and has actually witnessed our future. And for that to be the case, that individual is as God presents himself. That individual is akin to light. And so it tells us who he is, what he is, and what we will become. It also deals with these issues where it removes the notion that what Paul wrote is the total nature, I should say, of the Godhead resided on him bodily. That's impossible. Once you understand the difference between energy and matter, and that matter is a diminished form of energy, and that the relationship between energy and matter requires matter to be multiplied by the square of the speed of light, tells you how radically different these things are. And so Yahusha can be made comprised of the exact same material as Yahweh, but he can't be equivalent to him. He can't be equal to him, which is why he said he was a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. The moment you recognize that, then you know your attention ought to be where he told you to place your attention, on Yahweh, not Yahusha. But you understand the relationship between them. You understand the relationship between Yahweh and the set-apart spirit. You understand the promise of the covenant, which is to empower us. That is, the fifth promise of the covenant is to make us greater than we are. The ultimate way to do that is to change us from being material to being light energy. And then when you do that, you all of a sudden understand why this universe is so enormous, because we're going to have the opportunity to explore it, something we could not do until we become children of the covenant. And then you understand why God has to create a new universe at the end of the millennial Shabbat, because if he didn't, then our ability to travel in time would cause us to be sorrowful because we would be able to see our own cruddy mistakes and many of the hurtful things that man did to his fellow man. And so there would be great sorrow in eternity if we could travel back in time in the present universe. So since we're going to be able to explore and travel the vastness of an enormous universe, God's going to create a new one and let us be witnesses to it. So we get to explore that one with him right from the beginning. Everything falls into place. And the essence of it is that the moment you understand how God filled his Torah, prophets, and Psalms with future history to prove his existence and that his authorship of these texts, then you know this is the place we ought to focus if we want to know him, if we want to live with him, if we want to know what he is offering and what he is asking of us. And so the more you understand this, the better position you are to know who to trust and where to turn for answers. Now, returning to the basic presentation of this differential in time so that we understand the Genesis account itself. At creation, energy transitioned into matter consistent with Einstein's E equals mc squared. And by the way, if light traveled faster then, it just means that it took even more energy to create the matter that we're witnessing, which could be the reason why 96% of the energy and matter in the universe is unknown to us because of the variable there, which is C, representing the speed of light, squared, becomes a enormously larger number when the speed of light is 10 to the 10th power faster than it is today. So it requires enormous amounts of energy, and maybe 10 to the 10th power more energy than we can even fathom to conceive the universe that we witness. This initial transition from energy to substance occurred when the universe was a million times smaller and hotter than it is today. And we know that this is the point when time began because time only takes hold when matter forms. From the relative perspective of photon wave energy, time literally stands still. Now that's the answer to eternity. God can only make us immortal when we are no longer physical. This notion that's promoted by Christianity and Islam of a physical body in eternity is utter rubbish. It would be counterproductive. You can't be immortal and physical. That's the myth that there was a bodily resurrection of Yahusha, that God died, he was killed by man, and then bodily rose on Easter, is wrong in every possible way. His physical body was as the Passover lamb was destroyed that evening. God incinerated it in accordance with his Torah teaching. Yahusha's soul, which is the life of the individual, did not die, could not die, went to the place of separation on matzah, unleavened bread, paying the price to remove yeast from our souls so that we would appear perfect in God's eyes. He paid the price so that God could remain just and vindicate us. And then on the third day, on Bukurim, on first fruits, Yahusha's soul, released from Sheol, was re-energized, was reconnected with Yahweh's set-apart spirit, and that is why this spiritually born entity that could take on aspects of physical form but was primarily energy was unrecognizable to everyone he saw. No one recognized him. That was the common thread of all of those presentations. There was no physical bodily resurrection. He was unrecognizable. He was a new creation just as we will be. He was able to transport himself great distances in no time at all, as he was appeared on the that morning and then went to heaven to be with Yah, and then transported himself to on the road to Emmaus, and then literally walked through a wall and was in the upper room with his disciples. All of that requires energy as opposed to matter. But energy can always be transformed, be diminished into matter. So some aspect of energy can all energy can be diminished to become matter when it suits that source of energy. And so you can be perceived as having physical form. And that's handy, because without physical form, you can't sing. You can't enjoy a good meal. You can't converse the way we're conversing. There are times when the ordinary flow of time and a physical presence is beneficial. But that's the beauty of all of this, is that when that is appropriate, you can always transition from energy to matter and back to energy, because matter is nothing more than diminished and organized energy. So that all being understood, we recognize that the measurements in the most advanced physics laboratory reveal that the temperature and thus frequency of radiation at the instance of creation was 10 to the 12th times hotter than the 2.73 degrees Kelvin we now observe in the blackness of space. So since the Big Bang temperatures were a trillion times hotter or more energy intense than what is observed today in the cosmic microwave background radiation, it means that the electromagnetic wavelength must have been a trillion times shorter than it is now at its present trillion times lower temperature. And when we understand this, we will be able to calibrate our clocks here on Earth to Yahweh's clock at creation. Back in a moment. Back to the final segment of Shattering Myths. We'll be on this topic, which is creation, here for some time. We're going to transition not only from trying to calibrate our clocks based upon the nature of light and time to creation, so that we understand God's presentation of what happened in each of the six creative days, and understand his formula of 6 + 1 = 7, the time that we spend with him. We will move on from this to Yah's testimony on the conception of plant life, to what happened on the fourth day and the message to us on the fourth day of the sign of the sun and the moon becoming visible to us, and then moving to the creation of animal life and what God said and how that equates to what we know from the fossil record, and then to the sixth day where Adam and Chawa are conceived, and their uniqueness of Adam and Chawa relative to the one thing that sets Adam, therefore humankind, at least that individual, apart from the rest of humanity that existed outside of the garden, which was a nasalma, which is a conscience, the ability to exercise good judgment. From there, we will devote a number of shows to the conditions that existed in the Gan Eden, the Garden of Great Joy, the Garden of Eden. It is a fascinating study, because ultimately, we as on this earth are going to be taken back to that status for 1,000 years. Our return to the conditions experienced at the Garden of Eden is going to begin in just over 20 years from now and going to last for 1,000 years. And in that story, you come to understand the nature of the covenant relationship God seeks with us. From there, we're going to devote a number of shows to the flood. I'm sure you're going to find this fascinating, because we're going to equate what we absolutely know for certain happened, where it happened, how it happened, with God's testimony that describes it just that way. I'm positive that you'll be intrigued by what we can actually learn by examining both earth science and Yah's testimony relative to the reasons behind the deluge. And following that, there'll be several programs, in fact, several weeks of programs on Yahweh's relationship with Abram, who became Abraham, and the terms and conditions, as well as the benefits associated with the covenant. All of that comes from the first volume of a book that I first wrote almost 10 years ago, and have probably edited and corrected 10 times over the that period of time, called Yada Yah, which means to know Yah. But right now we're in a discussion of calibrating clocks to creation time, and we know now that the higher the temperature, the higher the frequency of the wave, and the higher the frequency, the shorter the wavelength must be. Girded with this knowledge, we can use recent nuclear laboratory calculations to deduce that the CBM, the cosmic background microwave radiation, is stretched by a factor of approximately 10 to the 12th, or 1 million million times, to 1, slowing the cosmic clock at creation relative to Earth by that amount. Therefore, on average, these four measurements confirm that one day in the Creator's life at creation would have seemed like 0.9 times 10 to the 12th days to us. And none of this should be surprising, since Yahweh consistently equates his nature to light, and since that we know that at the velocity of light, time stands still. Eternity only exists in the presence of light. Therefore, before we examine the calculations calibrating Genesis time to our own, to ascertain how God and man can both be accurate and yet differ relative to our clocks, our timepieces, let's take a moment to explore some of the cosmological assumptions that have led us to our current state of awareness. To begin, cosmologists contend that a concentration of energy at the initiation of the universe produced electromagnetic waves, or photons, that were forged as the explosion cooled sufficiently to permit matter to form. Persisting to this day, the photons have traveled out in all directions. This thermal soup of quarks, if you will, of electrons and photons, decreased in temperature rapidly, falling from 10 to the 13th degrees Kelvin to 1 billion degrees after just the first few minutes, a temperature still 67 times hotter at that moment than the core temperature of our sun. Now, we will return to this in our program tomorrow when we consider the vast temperature changes and time changes relative to creation.
If you suffer seasonal or environmental allergies and your doctor has told you that the only answer is medications for the rest of your life, Dr. Peter Glidden,